Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. When John Adams, who later became the second president of the United States, lived in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in August of 1774 to attend the First Continental Congress, he was greeted by leading citizens and immediately taken to the tavern that he would call the most genteel tavern in America. The City Tavern, as it was called, was not yet a year old, but already was caught up in the momentous events of the time. A few months later, Paul Revere rode up to the tavern with the news that the British government had closed the port of Boston. Some of the most influential people in the colonies began to gather in Philadelphia to decide on a response to this and other intolerable acts of the British government. For the next decade, the City Tavern would be a familiar sight to leading figures of the American Revolution. In the summer of 1994, I had lunch at the City Tavern with Benjamin Franklin, as portrayed by Ralph Archbold, and recorded our conversation. Over lunch, we talked about many aspects, past and present, of American life. First, however, I asked him about the history of the City Tavern itself.
This is a wonderful place here to dine. It is probably, as it has been described, a most genteel tavern, the most in America. And it was built in 1773, but became the place where we would meet after our meetings in the State House. We would come here to the tavern. Some of the delegates would lodge here in the upper floors. In fact, the Hennessy family at one point was introducing cognac to America. In the long room upstairs, they had a reception inviting all of the delegates to our federal convention, and we encouraged them to continue to bring cognac into America. We had our final dinner after our federal convention, which I believe you call a constitutional convention today, here at the City Tavern. And it is rumored that on Dock Street, just behind the tavern, Gouverneur Morris lost his leg in a carriage accident on one rainy day, the cobblestones being rather slippery and difficult to negotiate in the rain. When his leg slipped under the wheel of a carriage. He was rather proud to tell the story that he was escaping from a jealous husband, but I think that he may have been exaggerating.
I'd like to ask you some questions about your perspective on the United States in your 288 years of opportunity to view the birth and the growth and development of the country. And when we talk about cognac, we follow the history of alcohol in America and perhaps the effect that it's had on America, both politically and socially, the temperance issues, and now overconsumption in some parts and underconsumption, if you will, in others.
Well, underconsumption was never a problem here in Philadelphia. The water was a bit of a problem. The wells and the privy pits were a bit too close together and seemed to be indistinguishable at times. The Delaware River was very polluted. We had a lot of applejack. My favorite was an orange shrub, the recipe for which is to take a gallon of rum, 2 quarts of orange juice, 2 pounds of sugar, mix them together, put them in a cask, let them season for 3 to 4 weeks, and when opening the cask, don't plan anything for several days. But there were hearty appetites of consumption, and I always enjoyed a glass of Madeira. It didn't have the same tax as some of the other wines, and I noticed that animals with long legs have long necks so they can bend to drink, But man had to rely upon the arm to bring the glass to the lips. Now, were the elbow situated close to the wrist, the glass could not rise to the lips, and were the elbow closer to the shoulder, one would miss entirely. So by its exact placement at the point where the arm could bend to raise a glass to the lips, it was obvious to me that we were meant to drink and to enjoy. In Poor Richard's Almanac and in a little poem I wrote, I said, there cannot be good living unless there's good drinking, wine being the Lord's way of saying enjoy yourself and constant proof that God loves us. Of course, I did say moderation in everything, and we do have to be careful. Though when I was seeking some cannon from New York during the French-Indian War, and they had allowed as they had none to spare, I did take a supply of wine, and treating my host to some very good vintage, I found after two bottles they had accorded me two cannon. By the end of the evening, consuming the entire supply I had brought, I returned to Philadelphia with, I believe, 14 or 16 cannon. And the wine having loosened up the resolve of the New Yorkers not to give me any cannon. So wine can be a negotiating lubricant and has been used that way in many occasions in the parlors and in the negotiating chambers of high officials as well as in the boardrooms of corporations.
By cannon, you speak of the elements of war, the guns of war?
The guns of war. Cannons were also used for ceremonial purposes to announce important visitors and great events. And, of course, were very important in the early years as an instrument of war. During our revolution, when I was over in Paris, I was sent to get the help of the French. We needed ships, we needed guns, we needed cannons, we needed gunpowder, we needed money. And now we need a little mushroom bisque, which they're serving here at the City Tavern, which is one of the fine dishes that we have enjoyed here in Philadelphia over these many years.
Ben Franklin, let me ask you about electricity. You had some of the earlier experiments with electricity that has now resulted in allowing people to send a piece of paper over telephone lines or, as we were doing this past weekend, receive electronic photo images of comets crashing into Jupiter 500 million miles away. What are some of your reflections on the growth and development of that phenomena that we call electricity?
Well, it is amazing to see what has been done with electricity over the years. And, of course, I would have invented all of those things, but I was a little busy in Paris. My experiments with electricity were very basic, and I first learned about electricity 6 years before that famous experiment with the kite and the key, when a man came to America lecturing about electricity and had a gadget. His name was Spencer. He had a gadget that was supposed to make a spark, and I, about the same time, received a glass tube from Peter Collinson in London. Rubbing the tube with silk and wool, I found I got a shock, and I was very curious about it. And the great curiosity that I've always had led to experimenting for 6 years before that experiment with the kite and the key to discover if lightning indeed was electricity. However, even after all of that, we really had no use for it. The biggest use of electricity in the early days was that of gentlemen who had a static electric generator they would carry about from town to town, set up in the center of your town, and people would line up and pay money to get a shock. Now, when I look at all of the things, all the uses, I could not even imagine all of these wonderful uses for electricity. But I've always had an open mind. I remember when in Paris in 1783, I was there and the first balloons were going up in the air, hot air balloons and gas balloons, and a man turned to me and said, what good can that be? What possible good could a balloon be? And I said, what good is a newborn baby? Electricity was that way. It was a newborn baby, and now the advances are coming so rapidly. But you'll notice that each is a step along the way, and they rely upon someone to be the catalyst. For 2,000 years, we had known about electricity ever since a Greek gentleman rubbed a piece of amber on his tunic and attracted some feathers, and nothing had been done. And now you're doing all of it.
Let me ask you about your experiment with the key. How did you get it up onto the kite line up into the sky at the end of your kite?
Well, of course, the key was down near my hand. What I had was a large kite, about 4 foot high, with a silk cloth, and that kite had a little wire sticking, a stiff pointed piece of wire sticking above the top of the kite, about a foot above the top of the kite, which I hoped would attract the lightning, since the electrical fire, as I called it, seemed to be drawn by pointed pieces of metal. And that electric fire would then follow down to the string, come down the string, which was wet from the rain, to the key. The key was on the string near my hand, and of course I didn't want the lightning to come past the key and go into me. I needed some protection, and I had been reading that two gentlemen in France learned that silk did not conduct electricity. So I thought if I put a piece of silk between the key and my hand, keeping it dry under an overhang of a small building, that I might be safe. Now, I really would not have been safe had lightning actually struck the kite. However, what I received was a charge of electricity from the clouds, enough to make a spark at the key, not enough to do any serious damage. And, of course, within a year after that experiment, scientists throughout the world were trying to duplicate it, which was a very dangerous thing to do. There were several injuries, and a Russian scientist, named Richman, over in St. Petersburg, was killed doing some of my experiments.
What was the theory or the hypothesis that you were seeking to prove with this experiment?
All I really wanted to show was that lightning and electricity were the same thing. I had been making little sparks of electricity with a generator, and I noticed that lightning was the same color. They were both bright, they were both fast, they were the same color, and I wanted to prove that they indeed were the same thing. And, of course, I was successful in that. And really the great value was that other scientists then took up those experiments, which were described in very simple language so that anyone could pick up the paper and duplicate the experiments. And then they started thinking about the possibilities.
Your picture is on the $100 bill, something that too many of us have not enough of. May I have your reflections on that? That's a pretty important place to be.
Well, you know, my good friend George Washington is only on the $1 bill. And I told him, I said, George, you're only on the one because of your habits. Everyone has heard about you. You slept here, you slept there, you slept everywhere. And you'd never hear that about me. I was there, of course, but I never slept. But I think people would rather have a $100 bill, and I think that being on the $100 bill, if you take 100 pictures of George and buy one of those $100 bills, you should try to hang on to it. It's a very nice denomination. And when I reflect upon the things I've done, well, I feel a deep satisfaction in each and every one. There were quite a few inventions, gadgets, if you will. Traveling to France and all was really quite a thrill. But the thing that really impresses me this far over the hill is that they've got my face up there on that $100 bill. Now, the likeness, that's not the greatest. A little heavy in the jowls, but it was George who had the scowl, but it's a pleasant denomination. Not too large, not too small. A gentleman's denomination. A C-note, if you will. And little did my mother dream when she placed me on my pillow that this tender little face would grace that $100 billow.
Let me take a moment and say that you're listening to Radio Curious. My name is Barry Vogel. This evening's program is an interview that I had with Benjamin Franklin at the City Tavern, an old restaurant in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We spoke over lunch on July 18th, 1994. The clinking that you hear in the background comes from other people also having lunch. In the recent history and in our current times in the United States, there are a lot of people such as yourself who are portraying famous figures from the past. I'd like to know your thoughts on the reasons for this and the what it represents. Why now instead of then? And perhaps where are we going with it?
Well, I don't know where you're going with it, but I do know that it's nice to see a great interest in what has gone on at the beginning of this nation and throughout the fundamental growth periods of our nation, the struggles, the trials. And I think people like to look back. They like to remember what has happened in the past. This is a very fast-paced world today. So much is going on. There's so many advances in knowledge and all of the gadgets, all of the wonderful electronics that you do have. And people like to slow down a little bit and take a look at what has happened in the past and where their roots are. And I think that's important. I hope that they will appreciate what was going on here in Philadelphia in the early years of our nation with our Second Continental Congress and our Federal Convention and with our Bill of Rights and what we tried to give you. And what we did try to give you was a nation that was free, a nation that was independent under a constitution that began with the words, "We the People," for a very special reason. In the past, governments always told the people how they would govern them, and we thought that here in America, the people should have the right to tell their government how it would govern them. A government of the people, by the people, and for the people was a very important idea, but one that could only work if people would become involved, if they would learn about their government, if they would take part in their government.
In the 200 years since our government has been operating under the founding principles that you helped create, do you feel that it is a government of the people and by the people and for the people?
I feel certainly it is up to the people to keep it a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and I think for the most part that has been the case. However, in the fast-paced world I see around me today, I think more and more people are leaving this birthright that we have tried to give them to others and not taking enough involvement on their own.
What involvement do you recommend be taken?
I think it is important that everyone be informed, as informed citizens. You know, we had a very limited access to information in the early years, but everyone exchanged information freely, worked very hard to find the answers to the problems that we had, realizing that you can only solve your problems if you are willing to discuss your differences, to find your points of agreement, to work together, to cooperate, and to compromise to solve problems. That must take place today also.
I think that in many situations, working together to discuss and solve problems is a real key. But getting that key to the lock and opening it is a real question.
I think you need to go back to the system we had when I came here to Philadelphia of the juntos. They were discussion clubs, and we would get together, my friends and I, we were part of the Leather Apron group here in Philadelphia, working in the trades. But we would pose questions that were of importance to our citizenry. And each week we would take a question home and consider possible solutions, and we would come back the following week.
What were some of the questions that you would review?
We would review all of the issues of the day, how we might improve our city. For instance, we had a problem in the evening where people wouldn't come down to the shops, for they could not see. We came up with a suggestion of street lighting. We came up with, as an outgrowth of some of these discussions, we came up with a hospital here in Philadelphia. We started paving streets, all civic improvements that were important to our city. And as you tackle problems, you become more attuned to solutions. It's a habit pattern that establishes itself upon constant use. The more you think about solving problems and possible solutions, the quicker the solutions become available and are actually put into action. And that, of course, is the key. All the talking is meaningless if no action is taken.
We were talking earlier about a current problem here in the city of Philadelphia that affects your work and your interpretive history of yourself and your experience in the past 288 years. And that is how the National Park Service and the City of Philadelphia work together to present this interpretive history, this interpretation of history.
Well, you know, the Park Service has a great duty, a duty to preserve the past with accuracy, and that is a very important charge. Now, the city has another goal, and that goal is to further commerce, to further the well-being of its citizenry through economics. And they don't always agree. The Park Service has done a very wonderful job of interpretation and accuracy in preserving this history. The city would like to see a little more of the glamour. But the great danger is in, if I may use a term I have heard most recently, Disneyfying everything. There needs to be that balance, and the history needs to be preserved with accuracy. But we also need enough of the showmanship so that we can attract visitors. And I think every young student, every fifth grader and eighth grader who studies American history should at one time or another come to Philadelphia to touch the Liberty Bell, to walk the paths of independence, to stop in Carpenter's Hall, where our first Continental Congress met, to go into the State House, which is called Independence Hall today, where the Declaration was being debated and the Constitution was signed, and to stand here and look at what happened 200 years ago that affects them today as American citizens, a nation free, a nation independent. A great gift that we tried to give to future generations, but a gift that we didn't know would last. I was worried about America, a nation with all the advantages of climate and soils and great navigable rivers and lakes. What would become of her? Well, it has become a great nation.
Your friend Thomas Jefferson talks about the concept of usufruct, of using up now what really belongs to future generations, that the earth belongs to the living and should not be used or ruined by us at the expense of our children and grandchildren. He gives what I believe a current example would be the national debt. How do you see that evolving in American history, considering that when you first came here to Philadelphia, the frontier was not far away, and what we have found to lay beyond the frontier was almost limitless, but now we have reached it at the Pacific Ocean.
You have only reached one frontier. There will always be new frontiers for man and for mankind. The universe is limitless, and as each frontier is, as you say, conquered, there will be new ones that will be approached. However, there is a very great responsibility for each generation, and that is a responsibility that they not consider their selfish interests over the interests of the future. And the great temptation of all is to provide for themselves and for their children and perhaps forget that their great-grandchildren, must also be cared for. And what we do today is going to determine the future of this nation and this world. I see a great deal of selfishness and self-interest, but that has always been so. It is why we ended up becoming the United States of America, for we could not receive the respect that we wanted as a nation that could provide, as a nation that had a reason to be consulted, a reason to be respected. And that's all we all want. That's all any of us wants, to be respected for our energies, for our talents, for the contribution that we make. We must make sure that that contribution is a worthy contribution, one that is lasting, one that is not depleting. For if we deplete all of the resources, if we take away what belongs to future generations, then we have lost our sense of purpose.
A few years before you started your work here in Philadelphia, the concept of the King's Charters, which has now evolved into corporations, came into being and evolved. And essentially, a corporation allows the creation of a fictitious group to take the best wisdom of many different people and use it for perhaps the benefit of that fictitious group. In many cases now in America, I would call it to make money, as opposed to what you were just talking about, for the best of our community. May I have your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there is nothing wrong with making money, for I, too, have had enterprises that were revolving around the importance of money. But there is a responsibility with money. And to take an entity and to combine the resources for selfish interests may not be entirely in the interests of our nation and our world. However, if these corporations can be made responsible and responsive to the general public interest, perhaps much can be accomplished. And I don't know if that is possible. For you seem to have grown beyond anything that we could have imagined in the corporate world here today. Our businesses were small, our businesses were individual businesses, and I would hope that the climate for the individual entrepreneur, the individual business person, would be preserved and not cast aside because of the interests of the giant conglomerates that I see here in America today. I know that these are public corporations, but their only concern sometimes seems to be, as you call it, the bottom line. And quite frankly, the bottom line is more than dollars. It has to be if this world is going to survive.
This conversation with Benjamin Franklin, as portrayed by Ralph Archbold, was recorded in the City Tavern of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the summer of 1994. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.